You're listening to The Cutting Edge, presented by Hilleberg the Tent Maker.
Hi, I'm Petra Hilleberg, president and CEO of Hilleberg the Tent Maker. My dad, Bo Hilleberg, a lifelong outdoorsman, founded Hilleberg 50 years ago, and we've been family-owned, family-operated, and European-made ever since. We proudly specialize in building strong, lightweight tents and in never compromising on quality of materials or construction. Our tents have been specifically chosen by polar expeditions, mountaineers, backpackers, and avid outdoor adventurers just like you all over the world. We build tents for everyone's adventure.
We get additional support from Bivouac Coffee, a craft roastery making naturally processed and sustainably roasted coffees in the foothills of the Rocky Mountains. And from Blue Ice, makers of lightweight, robust gear for serious climbers and skiers, developed and tested in Chamonix and in Utah's Wasatch Range. This is Dougal MacDonald, editor of the American Alpine Journal and host of this show. The word historic is hugely overused when it comes to climbing achievements, but I'm betting that when the history of 21st century Himalayan climbing is written, the ascent described in this episode will be right in there. On October 12th, climbers Matt Cornell, Jackson Marvell, and Alan Rousseau summited 7,710 meter Janu, or Kumbhakarna, by a new route up the north face, climbed in alpine style. It was Alan's third attempt on this peak in Nepal, having tried once before with Jackson and once with Matt. Janu's main north face had only been climbed once, in 2004, by a 12-man Russian team that spent nearly 2 months on the face and fixed over 10,000 feet of rope. The American trio carried a single lead rope and took only a modest rack and no bulk kit. Their route, round-trip ticket, was climbed and descended in 1 week. The two-day push up the north face headwall required sustained and extremely difficult ice and mix climbing on a new route up to about 7,500 meters. Three of the bivouacs on the face were fully hanging. Years of preparation and innovation went into this remarkable ascent. But it's also important to say that, as you'd expect with a climb of such difficulty at such high altitude, the margins were very thin. Their climb and descent were utterly exhausting, and two of the three climbers got frostbite near the end of their week on the mountain. Back in base camp, they decided to call for a helicopter evacuation, for two reasons. They were worried about the possibility of infection if they hiked out, and they had learned that if they could make it quickly to a hospital in Kathmandu, they would be able to take a drug called iloprost, which improves blood circulation and can help in some frostbite cases. The two were required to spend 5 days under observation at the hospital while taking that drug. Fortunately, they appear to be recovering well. It's easy to fall into the trap of glorifying bold ascents, and that's why I wanted to share the aftermath of the Janu climb up front, as context for this episode. The risks and consequences of this climb were very real. Still, from everything I've learned about the climb and heard in my interview with these three, this was not a story of rolling the dice, but of extensive planning, creativity, teamwork, and skill, along with good luck, leading to a proud performance on the grandest of Himalayan stages. Here's Alan, Matt, and Jackson to tell their story. Welcome, Alan, Jackson, and Matt. Why don't you each introduce yourselves and say where you live, just to help listeners recognize your voices.
I'm Alan. I live in Salt Lake City, Utah.
I'm Jackson, and I live in Heber, Utah.
I'm Matt, and I live in Groveland, California.
Right. So before we get started, Alan and Jackson, you guys both had some frostbite injuries from the climb we're going to be talking about. And I just wanted to ask how you're doing and what's the prognosis?
Well, thanks for asking. I think all things considered, we're both doing pretty good. We both ended up on it with just one hand. And I think kind of fairly similar injuries for both of us. And I would say worst case deal, each of us will lose the tip of one pinky. Also a pretty solid chance that we will make it out without losing anything. But just going to take a little bit of time. It'll probably be quite a bit more mellow of a winter than both of us are used to having, but we are optimistic that it won't really change much for us in the long haul.
Fingers crossed for a full recovery.
So your expedition last month was the third in 3 years to Janu. Why don't you tell us about the origin of this project?
Who wants to take this one?
Why don't you, Alan?
Oh, I see how this is going to go. Yeah.
Sure.
I don't know. It was a long time ago that I sort of stumbled across what had been done on the north face of Janu, and that it was kind of this mega feature and sort of one of the more intimidating, maybe the most intimidating face that I had come across. At the time, it seemed super out of reach and far off, and kind of the only way that seemed feasible for me in order to climb it was similar to like the 50-day siege that the Russian team had done in 2004, and that didn't really appeal to me very much. And then during COVID, Jackson sort of asked me if I'd be interested in going to the Himalayas, and the sort of style of what we had done before then was I would just kind of throw out the most audacious thing whenever Jackson asked me if I wanted to climb with him, and then he would always blindly agree, and then I'd be like, oh shit, well, I guess we're gonna do this now. And so that was kind of, I guess, sort of how it began. And then having like access to the G7 pod portal edges sort of made it seem like something that would be feasible to do in an alpine style. And yeah, that's kind of how I remember it sort of coming into a thing. Jackson, do you have anything else that you remember about it, about starting to formulate the idea?
Yeah, like before we'd sort of talked about going to the Himalayas, I'd seen that photo of the east face of Janu East, I believe it was, or the Russian route on Janu East that had just been put down. I mean, that sort of got me looking in the area, but I hadn't really looked at the north face. So once Alan brought up checking that out, I was like pretty inspired and on board.
Mm-hmm. Why don't you guys just briefly describe this face? I mean, it's pretty complex. It's described as being 2,700 vertical meters. I mean, just enormous. Is that the distance above the glacier, and is it all technical, or give us a brief description? How about you, Matt?
Yeah, I can jump in here. It was, I think the vertical relief is the 2,700 meters from the dry glacier to the summit. And you kind of start out climbing a rock buttress for, I don't know, 600 to 700 meters, and difficulties up to about 5'8". It's generally pretty mossy and it's hard to hit in dry conditions, so it makes the climbing a little more difficult. It's usually wet or snowy most of the times that we've ever climbed it. And then from there, kind of get a little reprieve from technical climbing, and you work your way through an ice fall, kind of like weaving through crevasses. You kind of stay on the edge of it, so it's not too bad, mostly just snow walking. And you get to a plateau at about, what is that, 19,000 feet? And from there, that's kind of when you access the start of the real mountain. So you climb like a 3,000-foot ramp that gets you to the base of the headwall. And then from there, it's pretty technical to the top.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that the headwall is just sort of the astonishing feature of the mountain. It gains, I don't know, between 500 and 700 meters at the very top of the face, and all of it vertical or overhanging. And the headwall had only been climbed once, never in alpine style. Alan, you mentioned the Russian team that climbed that direct route up the headwall in 2004. Did you consider attempting the Russian line when you first looked at this?
That was sort of the initial plan that we had was to try and like repeat the Russian line in an alpine style. And then as we sort of got there, we realized like how much there was a lot of hardware in place on the lower buttress. And we saw kind of chunks of fixed rope here and there on the ramp and stuff. And we had a little bit of our mentality on it was like, well, there's going to be a lot of like in situ gear on this Russian line, repeating it and probably some ropes around. And that's going to kind of feel a little weird climbing through there. And then also we felt pretty strongly from a risk management perspective to climb it in post monsoon when a lot of the wall is caked in ice to mitigate a lot of the rockfall hazard. Cause the Russian team had quite a few injuries related to rockfall climbing it. They eventually succeeded climbing pre-monsoon, and we found there to be kind of less hazard on the face post-monsoon. And That Russian line has a lot of like the chimney system. It follows largely a chimney system that has like a lot of small roofs. And that whole section of the wall in there was just like kind of filled with mushrooms, like snow mushrooms, it is. So we felt like that'd be a bit hard to manage in terms of like not jeopardizing where the belayer was. So it's sort of a combo. And then also the line that we ended up finding just kind of seemed the most logical way through the head wall and had like quite a bit more ice on it, which appealed to all of us.
Did you guys go ever pre-monsoon, or were all of your attempts post-monsoon?
No, all of them were September and October.
Right. So your first attempt was in 2021, and it was Jackson and Allen. Did you attempt the line you eventually followed this year, or did you try something else?
Yeah. So in 2021, we were able to attempt the line that we ended up climbing this year, and we made it to about 7,100 meters or 7,150 meters, which is just a little bit above the start of the technical difficulties of the headwall.
Mm-hmm. So had you already decided before you left home that you weren't going to try the Russian line? I mean, this was, you always were looking for something new. And did you identify that line from pictures at home, or did you have to wait until you got there below the mountain?
Yeah, no, we ended up identifying that in base camp with the spotting scope. We were looking at the Russian line still seriously when we got to base camp, and then ended up deviating sort of once we got eyes on the wall and had time to sit below it for a while.
Mm-hmm. So then why did you turn around? I mean, I know you were somewhat surprised that you got as high as you did, but what happened that you turned around on that first attempt?
We were climbing sort of, it was an acclimatization run that we were on that we hit our high point that season. And there was some inclement weather coming in, or a storm coming in like 2 days from our high point. So we were sort of caught between a rock and a hard place of if we keep going, we could sort of get stuck in bad weather up here, or we can go down now and save energy for another attempt once the weather passes. And so we ended up calling it and heading down to base camp, hoping we'd get another chance to try again that season.
And then 2022, you started out as a party of three, but then Jackson had to go home early, right? What happened that year with you and Alan, Matt?
Well, we kind of had a big monsoon that year. So coming into it, the face was like very plastered with snow and ice. And it was visible from base camp that it was like a very heavy monsoon on the head wall. And a lot of things were plastered, and the monsoon just didn't really let up. We kind of spent a little over a month in base camp before we even got a window to attempt the face. And so by the time we were able to start climbing, it was already really cold, and the window we had was really windy. So we climbed to about 6,500 meters, didn't even get to like the top of the ramp feature, didn't get to the base of the headwall, and had a bivvy where pods were getting lifted up by the wind all night, and my feet were like getting frozen, like the socks were frozen in my feet when I was taking them out of the boots. It was just extremely cold, and climbing in those conditions was not too practical. So we ended up calling it.
What did those two prior attempts teach you about the route and what it would take to climb this face in alpine style? And did these attempts change your planning or tactics at all before this year?
I think the first year we realized just how cool that headwall was, and that it was like crazy, like the thing you sort of dream about. And it also really surprised us like how fast we could climb the lower buttress, and that like the ice fall was reasonable enough, and like the ramp wasn't quite like the first year. We were like, we might get to the bottom of this ramp feature at like 5,800 meters and just see a bunch of rocks flying by and be like, yeah, this isn't for me, and leave. But we had climbed that a few times without any incident, and we kind of realized like, whoa, we got like 8,000 feet up this 10,000 foot feature in 4 days. Like, this is in the right window with the right acclimatization. Like, we can do this, and it's going to be cool. And then the second year, when Matt and I were in there with kind of brutal weather and high winds creating a lot of hazard on the face, it's like, oh my God, like this is going to be, it was a little bit brutal, like having our high point of year two be a couple thousand feet below the high point of year one. But I think the first year also, we kind of realized that our kit was like pretty heavy, And we're like, this wall style objective would be like pretty sweet to climb as three people. So the three of us started climbing together more and realizing that that was like a really good match. And we're psyched to have Matt along. And I think the second year with me and Matt sort of reinforced, like, you know, it'd be sweet to have a team of three on this thing again. And so I think the main shift in our tactics, we're probably going from a team of two to a team of three and kind of learning how to climb fast and effectively together in that as a group. And I think the first year up there kind of, yeah, really showed us that it was sort of worth continuing to try until we got the right conditions to do it.
I would also add that from those 2 years of attempts, we were able to parse down the equipment that we brought by like quite a bit, from rack and ropes to our pod system and stuff.
Yeah, I want to talk about that. In fact, this is probably a good time to talk about the systems that you guys have developed over the past few years or sort of worked to perfect. And there are at least two that I'm aware of that seem quite innovative and that seem to have been critical to your success on Janu. And the first, I remember, Matt, when we interviewed you as part of a discussion of the fast times on the Slovak Direct on Denali, you said, quote, "That climb was kind of a test of our systems to see if they'll work on these bigger alpine faces. It was building the team and testing these systems before we go into the greater ranges." And I think you were mainly talking about the fix and follow technique. And I wonder if one of you could describe that tactic for the listeners and how you applied it on Janu.
Yeah, so that's exactly what I was alluding to, is the fix and follow, as well as Janu is our kind of objective that we were looking at to use these same rope systems. And so generally the idea is, if you're simul climbing, you'll throw micro tracks on a piece of gear one rope length apart. And so that way you always have a kind of running belay, something to catch the followers if they fall, as well as you can kind of pull rope up and belay through a tricky section using the micro if it's a good piece. But then for the fix and follow at altitude, that works really well because you can climb a pitch and then you fix the rope, so it's a static point, you're not belaying from above, and the followers will micro tracks the rope up. And so they can still climb the route, but they're belaying themselves, which is really efficient because the leader who just led the pitch can haul backpacks, take care of themselves, rest, because we're generally climbing in blocks. So one person will lead 3-4 pitches at a time, and you're just kind of all racked up, you're psyched, you're in a rhythm, and you can move really efficiently using those systems.
Is it mostly about sort of speed and efficiency, or is it also designed to allow everybody to climb instead of Jumaring, or both? What's the primary sort of benefit of the fix and follow?
I would say it's a little bit of both, where everyone gets to climb the route, or you can jug, depending on the difficulties. We definitely had to do some lower routes and things like that on Janu. So it facilitates that kind of Jumaring or aid, you could say, as well as it gives the leader a lot more time to rest. You're not there belaying, wasting energy. When you get to the belay and you get the packs hauled, you can drink some water, you can dig for a snack, you can get a puffy out, you can change your gloves. And so it really plays into efficiency, as well as being able to take care of yourself where everyone's kind of moving.
I mean, because if everybody were jugging a fixed line, then the leader could still do those same things.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, yeah.
So why fix and follow then?
Because it gives you an opportunity to also start leading the pitch after, because if you pull up a lot of rope, then once the first person gets up there, you can start taking off again on the next pitch above.
Mm-hmm. Right. So then that way it's kind of an adaptation of sort of Yosemite speed climbing technique.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Are there downsides to fix and follow? Are there places where you either couldn't use it because it wasn't feasible or might be too dangerous for some reason?
I would say if you're on a feature where there's like ice that is forming a lot of time, like if your ropes are icing up, that makes toothed devices like a microtrack pretty terrifying, because as soon as the teeth ice over, you have like zero friction on the rope. So I would say the types of conditions like where you have building ice conditions are not appropriate for using a microtrack device in general.
Did you discover anything else that sort of was new to you on Janu that, you know, I know you've practiced this technique in very serious faces, but did you learn anything new?
just that it's really awesome.
It's really fun to get to climb the pitches and not just be jugging as well. So it's a pretty huge bonus, I think, to that system.
Were you guys like, you know, really trying to free climb, or, you know, were you, especially as you're following, do you sort of just take rests wherever you feel like it? Or is it, is free climbing on a route like this important to you?
I think it is for the leader, just from like a efficiency standpoint. The follower, I think the follower is just always, I know in my head, it was just like, how can I get up this as efficiently as possible? So if it's like, looks particularly steep, I just, whatever, threw a second micro tracks on and jugged for a little bit. And then when it got faster to climb, I'd climb. And it was just like, my job as the follower was just to use as little energy as possible and get up to the anchor as fast as possible.
Mm-hmm. Now, I understand you took just one 60 meter, 9 millimeter rope. Is that correct? As a lead rope?
Yep.
It's not much. Is that another advantage of fix and follow? You need less rope. You're carrying less weight.
It definitely is. Yeah. Yeah. We used that. And then we used one 6 millimeter hyperstatic for our haul line and tag line. So yeah, definitely makes it nicer for hard climbing to not have like two climbers, like, you know, double end roped. Like, it'd be pretty hard on a lot of the pitches that we climb to be like timing your movement off of another climber if you were tied in like 20 feet apart from them. So we probably would have had to take like at minimum one single and one half, and then another tag line if we were planning on people like, you know, belaying two climbers independently up the route. So another rope likely would have had to enter into the system, which just kind of would have made it not really work.
Now, with just one rope and one lead rope, do you have any options if the rope gets damaged or chopped? I mean, could you continue? I guess it completely depends on the scenario, but I guess my main question is, are you confident you could get down somehow if the rope got chopped?
I mean, I think you run into that kind of regardless of the rope system. If one of your ropes gets core shot at the 30 meter mark, you're like, you're kind of in a bad way.
Still, you have more options with a couple of ropes.
I always think that there's a chance of getting down with the system that we were running. It would be take a lot more time, but with how much ice is on that face with the 60 meter hyperstatic, we could have wrapped. Mm-hmm. It would have just been brutal and time consuming.
Yeah.
You know, speaking of that rope, I was curious how you haul with a 6 mil rope. I mean, are you hauling all the packs and everything? There's a lot of weight. And do you use the micro tracks as well for that?
Yeah, we do. Just throw it through a micro tracks at the anchor. And then at least when I was doing it, when I was hauling, I was just throwing my second micro and body hauling.
Yeah. And it's like, you know, it's a 6 mil hyperstack. So it's a Dyneema core with a aramid fiber in the sheath as well. So it's like, yeah, in terms of the weight it can hold, it's like about as much as the 9 millimeter rope could.
Well, so the other big innovation that I'm aware of is your sleeping system, which, you know, people have been experimenting with these G7 pods, the lightweight inflatable hanging ledges that have been around for a few years, but it seems like you guys took it to another level. And I wonder if one of you could describe what you developed in conjunction with G7 and how that system worked on Jammu.
Yeah. So Nathan, one of the founders of G7, we've been talking with him for a few years, working on getting a sleep system that we thought would be, you know, the best thing for Jammu. And he ended up coming actually to Nepal while we were out there and delivering a sleep system to us, as well as a custom sleeping bag that he made. And so we ended up taking this custom sleeping bag up there with us that was a three-man elephant's foot with synthetic insulation and Dyneema exterior skin to it. And that ended up coming in at like 800 grams for total weight and packed down to about the size of probably less than one of our sleeping bags. So it definitely changed the game as far as the amount of bulk that we had to carry up there for our sleep system.
And what was the setup with the pods themselves?
We used two single G7 pods, and we do a combination depending on what the sleep situation was, whether we were hanging or if we could stomp out a platform. So if we were able to stomp out a platform, we could find a way to rig the fly above us, whether we were in like a Bergschrund or on like a little fin. And we just clip the outside straps up for support, but then the middle would be, we want to clip the middle strap so we could all three lay down and fully sleep that way. But then if we were hanging, we'd just kind of like sit up with our backs against the wall and kind of straddle the straps in between our legs and just kind of, you know, huddle in as best we can.
So the two pods, the two called mattresses, for want of a better word, are they sort of side by side, one close to the wall and one on the outside?
Yeah.
So you're sitting on the inside one with your legs out on the outside one, presumably?
Exactly. Yeah. Just kind of like, you know, they make like a classic double ledge, if you could imagine. You know, they have like the support straps in the middle, but they're just two individual pods or mattresses. And you just join them with carabiners. We tied them together with cord just so they have less play.
Do you have to blow these up when you get there?
Yeah.
That must be some joy at altitude.
They come with little inflation bags that help.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So you're not actually like using your lungs.
Thank goodness. So you're basically sitting up all night when you were, how many hanging bivouacs did you have?
We had three nights hanging.
And so you're sitting up basically like you're sitting on a ledge on a mountain, except you have some padding and, and shelter.
Yeah.
Do you sleep?
A little. not too much. You're pretty much just stirring all night. You might doze off for a little bit, but you're not really getting a full night's sleep.
I mean, do you feel like you recover in the morning just from the rest, or is there a real deterioration each day?
I mean, you definitely feel a little more rested in the morning, but I wouldn't say you get everything back. You definitely notice a deterioration in your mental capabilities as well as your physical, but it goes far to rest. Like at the end of the day, you feel pretty wrecked and you're like, I need to get some food and water in me and take care of myself and warm up, try to dry things out.
Did you come up with things you're going to go back to Nathan and say, well, now we need to do this?
Yeah, we have some ideas, but I mean, the system is like pretty good as it is. I mean, the pods are fully insulated, so you stay pretty warm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've certainly seen the pictures of you guys all sitting in there, and it does not look comfortable.
Yeah, we don't sleep that way at home. It's not, yeah.
Right. Yeah. It's not by choice. And you did answer one question I had, which is, so on flat ground or when you're not fully hanging, so you need something overhead to sort of hang the fly off of, but otherwise you can lie down inside these things?
Yeah, more or less. We'd usually find a way to like rig a rope over our heads to keep the fly off of us.
Mm-hmm. Were these the main innovations that you put to use on Janu, or is there something I'm missing?
I think that's it. I can't think of anything at the moment.
Do you think it would have been possible to climb the face without certainly the pods, but even with the fix and follow tactics? I mean, just from sort of speed and efficiency standpoint?
I mean, it's definitely possible. It's just the amount of time it's going to take. And if you can endure that as well as carry more weight and have the right weather and conditions for that, you know, it's going to be more difficult for sure. And having these innovations makes it a lot easier and efficient. But yeah, it's certainly possible. It's just a lot more effort.
Right.
I would say, I think with all the tricks and stuff that we used, it felt pretty close to the limit of what we could do at that point in time. I'll speak for myself at least in saying that.
After a couple of brief sponsor messages, we'll hear much more about the climb of Janu's North Face and what these three experienced high on that icy headwall. Bivouac Coffee is a craft roastery based in Colorado's Front Range foothills. They only roast natural process coffees, which have a much lower environmental impact, and this results in a low acidity, super smooth, and flavorful cup of coffee. Bivouac ships everywhere in the U.S., and they are offering podcast listeners 20% off their first order. Enter the code CUTTINGEDGE, all one word, at checkout on their website. The address is bivouac.coffee.
Hi, this is Bill Belcourt at Blue Ice. In climbing, weight is the enemy of success. Here at Blue Ice, we make some of the lightest climbing equipment in the world to give you a fighting chance at succeeding in your objectives. The rest is up to you. Good luck out there and enjoy the podcast.
Well, let's back up a little bit and talk about the climb. So how long were you in base camp before you started the climb, and what's the elevation there, and how did you acclimatize?
The base camp is around 15,000 feet.
What? 4,500 meters?
4,700 meters. Mm-hmm. Like the first week that we were there, we climbed up kind of on the south aspect above our base camp. And there's like fairly easy, like walking terrain in there. And we spent like one night at 18,000 feet. Then we spent another night at 20,000 feet. And then we came back down, hung out there for like maybe 2 or 3 days. And then we like repeated the same process again. And then, cause the weather was kind of too unsettled to get on the route. And then we dropped down into the village of Gunsa, which is at 11,000 feet. And we spent like, I want to say like 4 days there because the weather was still pretty bad. And so we figured we had kind of done our couple rotations up high and then we were going to like rest and recover down there and then try and kind of minimize the time that we're feeling like we were like festering in base camp for. And then we eventually, after like 4 days in Gunsa, we headed back up. And what, guys, we were in like base camp for another like 4 days or something like that.
That sounds right.
And then, yeah, we got the word that it was like just this high pressure that like kept growing. At first, it was like, you guys have got like 4 days. And then it's like, oh, the next day is cleared out in the forecast. So the next day is cleared out in the forecast. So the next day is cleared out in the forecast. And it turned out that it was like never like a 12-day high pressure or something like that. The winds ended up being a little bit higher than what they were forecast to be. But all in all, it was like pretty a pretty dang incredible time to be up high in the Himalayas.
And you were hanging out in base camp with Michael Gardner and Sam Hennessy, who were attempting a route on Janu East, ultimately unsuccessful, that they got quite high. Did you acclimatize with them and do stuff with them in that period, or pretty much stick to your own project?
We were all together for the both acclimatization runs and the approach in. And yeah, we were all on the same program, more or less.
And as you packed up for the climb, how many days and nights did you anticipate the climb taking? And sort of, did you have like sort of stretch food and that kind of thing, or stretch fuel?
We packed, if I remember right, 5 days of food and fuel. And then we had a couple extra meals that are high bivy or are the on top of the rock buttress for on the way down. Was that right, Alan?
Sounds about right. Yeah. We might have packed even a little bit more fuel than that. I think we had like,
do we take 6 days?
I think
days?
We maybe even brought 7 days, what we could stretch to 7 days of fuel. Mm-hmm. But I think we may have left one can at the top of the buttress to pick up on the way down or something.
So you start up that lower rock buttress and then you climb the long ramp. How long did it take to reach the start of the, where you sort of leave the Russian route and branch out onto the headwall?
2.5 days. It's around 7,000 meters that we deviate off of the Russian line.
Around 7,000 meters. Okay. And then you spent essentially 2 full days climbing the headwall. Is that correct?
Yep.
So what was the nature of the climbing there? Was it mostly ice or was it mixed? Were you using crampons and tools the whole time, or was there any sort of pure rock climbing?
Crampons and tools, sort of the whole headwall. I don't think anyone ever took their gloves off. Probably would have been in a lot more trouble than we are already if we had. Yeah, and the climbing up on the headwall was just phenomenal. A lot of these pockets of old crystals that were like perfect pick size that you could just like fit your pick into, and they were all over like blank faces. So you get into sort of a slabby looking section where we weren't really sure where we were going to go, and then there'd be a line of pockets that you could usually work through.
These are where crystals in the granite had broken out and left pockets.
Yeah.
Amazing.
The crystals were like still in there. So you're climbing by like all these beautiful quartz crystals.
You probably didn't get any pro in those pockets, but
I think there was a couple beaks placed in them and maybe a 0.1 or something at times. But no big holes where you could get like a number two or anything like that. Just mostly small gear.
Is the in a lot of the photos I saw, some of the ice looks really thin. Is it, do you think that the line that you ended up climbing is sort of highly condition dependent? And do you know if there was sort of more or less ice in those passages than when you saw it previously?
I think it's probably, it's like anything with mixed climbing, the grade varies so much depending on how thick the ice is and where the, how low the ice goes and all that sort of thing. I think it was in really fun conditions how we climbed it, and it was really cerebral kind of piecing together the ice smears that were there. And I, in terms of ice compared to other years, I think it was like a fairly similar amount of ice on the face to what we had seen in the previous 2 years. What do you guys feel any differently about that?
No, I think it was, yeah, pretty similar to what we saw in 2021, especially from like how it climbed at our high point. It seemed like a similar amount of ice.
So it'll be a trade route soon. So that's good. Were you following a feature? Like, where does the, is there a line, like an obvious line, or is it, you talked about sort of piecing stuff together across slabs and things, but are you generally following a feature?
It's like an arcing open book, kind of like a crescent shaped open book. And yeah, the two things that kind of drew us into it were, there was, in terms of like, I think the big hazard on the face post monsoon is mushrooms, that are snow mushrooms, nice mushrooms. That line had a couple of them on it, but in terms of the rest of the face, it was fairly void of them. And then always nice if you have a slightly traversing feature in terms of, you know, ice and mixed climbing, not shelling your belayers and that kind of thing. So, and then just the fact that there was a fairly, like, there's definitely a few major question marks when we headed up the face, but there was like a fairly defined line, like looking through with the scope of like, oh, this smear almost connects with that smear, almost connects with that one. Then you got this like chimney system. So it's like a fairly, I think a number of other teams that had tried it before us had sort of identified the same weakness. And I think out of the few people I've talked to that had tried the face previously in an alpine style, that was their plan, was to go through that same area.
How many attempts have there been? Do you know? Or I'm sure you've counted it up, but roughly how many attempts of an alpine style ascent of that main north face have there been?
I guess like at least a dozen. It seemed like it was kind of everybody was throwing themselves in it in the 90s to early 2000s.
Mm-hmm. They didn't have G7 pods, though.
They did not, no.
Now, it's a north face. Does it get any sun at all?
You get like 5 minutes as the sun set in.
Such a tease.
Yeah, because there's those classic photos of this, the face all lit up, you know, in alpenglow. So that's 5 minutes worth.
Yeah, about 5 minutes that like you get glaring sun on the face.
Oh, man. So really cold, obviously.
It's like 6 p.m. and there's like no like heat to it.
When did the frostbite injuries occur during the climb? My understanding was on the way up.
Yeah, so mine, I noticed that I had a blister probably like 100 meters from the summit, and that the end of my pinky was discolored a little bit. And yeah, we decided to keep going to the top, making the decision that it probably wouldn't change the outcome of my pinky drastically to spend another hour or two moving up.
Mm-hmm. And Alan, was that the same for you or different?
No, mine occurred on the descent. I didn't really realize what had happened until we were done with the rappels.
Hmm.
The morning that we began our descent, all my fingers had like a normal coloration to them.
Hmm. I'd also like to talk a little bit about hard climbing at this altitude. I don't like to make comparisons among climbs, but it did strike me that the hardest climbing on your route took place above 7,000 meters, which is considerably higher than some of the other hard routes that have been done at altitude in recent years. I mean, the technical climbing on the southeast ridge of Annapurna 3 ended at around 7,100 meters. Same for the northwest face of Sara Gerar, got done a year or two ago. The summits of Changabang, the summit of Pumari Chich East, are below 7,000 meters. I've never climbed above about 6,500 meters and only on easy grounds. And I think it's hard for people like me to understand what it's like trying to do hard technical climbing at such a high altitude. So I wonder if one or more of you just take a stab at describing what that's like and what the difficulties are. Jackson, you look like you're ready to go.
I was giving Alan the wink, but I'll take it. Yeah. So, I mean, when you're that high, for me anyway, it's all about keeping your breathing like patterned well to your movement so you don't run yourself out of breath. And I think one of the biggest challenges of pulling harder moves at that altitude is, you know, you can't always keep your movement coordinated. So when you do end up pulling like an awkward move and then you're stanced out, you know, spread out on your tools and sort of grip, you have to take that like a minute to sort of huff it out and breathe heavy for a minute. But yeah, really, really the goal for me is always to just try and coordinate the movement with my breathing as much as possible to try and keep it synchronized. But when you lose that balance, it becomes pretty pretty hard for a few minutes.
I feel like at altitude, a lot of times, like climbing that kind of like 65 degree neve is like some of the hardest stuff to do because you're not stopping to think about what your movement is. And you're kind of like, your brain is like, oh, you should be like cruising here. And it's like fatigue on the calves and your triceps from swinging and all that kind of stuff. And once you get into a little bit harder climbing, obviously, like you're exerting yourself from the standpoint of like hanging on to your tools, but it's almost like you're not. None of us expect the leader to climb particularly fast when you're heading into like a vertical or slightly overhung pitch at that altitude. So in a lot of ways, it's almost like, oh, okay, like pressure's kind of off. I just got to like figure this out and get through the pitch safely. And like you kind of naturally pace yourself while you're like on sighting through this tricky techie terrain up high. So there's obvious challenges to climbing harder technical pitches and altitude, but also in some ways, I think it almost aligns better with the pace that you should actually be moving at those heights.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, when it gets technical, it's like you're mentally engaged more, so it's easier to pace yourself. But I actually found communicating with my partners in belayer was much more difficult because I'd always be so out of breath and trying to recover. I could never let them know what I needed, whether that was slack or tension, or I was off belay even just. And we ended up doing like shorter pitches through a lot of the technicalities. I don't think we climbed much more than 100 feet per lead or pitch.
Mm-hmm. And that works with fix and follow as well then, because you pull the rope up and anchor it so you can be ready to go. Yeah,
exactly.
Was hauling desperate at that altitude?
You would definitely get out of breath. And when the packs got stuck, it was difficult, but it wasn't too bad. Definitely saved energy.
I mean, you guys have all been at altitude before, but were there any things that sort of surprised you that you didn't expect to be hard, but were? I mean, I know sleeping was a problem, but that for many reasons. Were there other things that came up that created difficulties?
I mean, that was everybody's first time above 7,500 meters. And I think just like the cumulative effect of that being like our sixth day of climbing, like up there to the summit and not sleeping very well and having a bunch of hard days stacked on top of each other, I think we all kind of anticipated, one, we expected the terrain to be quite a bit easier than it ended up being above 7,500 meters. And I think we were all fairly surprised just at like how slow we ended up moving at that point in time on the upper mountain. And it was probably like, I don't know, climbing up there probably took like 5 hours longer than any of us thought that it would that day. So roughly twice the amount of time that we like anticipated the up to be on that day was what reality was for us.
Yeah. So you topped out the head wall. Did you camp then on top of the head wall and then go to the summit the next day? Or?
We bivvied like one pitch below the shoulder. So that we spent two nights there. Like one night, like we climbed up to the summit and then used that same bivvy again another night. So yeah, it just got dark and we just ended up setting up kind of ironically. I think a lot of people are probably surprised that we didn't just climb another pitch and sleep on the shoulder and instead spent two nights free hanging in the pods. But that was what made sense to us at the time for whatever reason.
So once you got on the shoulder, then you climbed the summit tower by this 1983 French route, which I think was the finish. They climbed the Southwest Spur. I remember some photos that we published in the AHA of that finish when Babanoff and Kofanoff climbed the West Pillar. Mm-hmm. And it does not look easy. You've said that it was harder than you expected.
Yeah. Yeah.
What did you find up there? It's not quite as steep, but what made it difficult?
I think we were kind of expecting more like rampy climbing, and there were like for sure vertical like pitches and steps that we were climbing. The terrain was definitely a nice change, was that the sections that were vertical were like comparatively short lived. And then we had like whatever, a section of neve or a section of snow that kind of separated the pitches. But I think, you know, we were pretty beat by the time we got up to that height. And it was still like pretty intimidating climbing through a lot of the steps. And I think we just, you know, anticipated whatever, a couple grades easier than what we ended up encountering there.
And so it was more or less all day up and down back to that hanging bivvy on the top of the head wall.
Yeah. I mean, I think we left that bivvy in our high bivvy in the morning at like maybe I don't know, 7 or 7:30 in the morning, and we topped out at 4:20 in the afternoon, and then didn't get back to that bivvy, like a lot of slow traversing rappels through the dark, and I think it was around 10 p.m. that we got back into that bivvy that night and set up.
You know, listening to you guys talking about the difficulties, the hard climbing, the altitude, the cramped bivvies and the cold, and I find myself wondering, how do you keep believing that you can do it? And I mean, you're sitting there, I was going to say lying in your sleeping bag, but that wasn't the case. Sitting in your sleeping bag in the early hours of the morning. And do you have doubts about continuing? And if so, how do you overcome them?
I don't remember like any specific point of doubting it. Like we kept getting forecasts every morning and it kept looking splitter in the extended forecast. And at least if I can speak for my partners here, I think we were all just like, well, we'll just keep on pushing until it doesn't make sense anymore. And it just kept making sense.
Is there any time that you have to do any cheerleading for each other, or is it all seemed pretty mutual how you were feeling? Were you all sort of on the same level throughout the climb?
I think we were all pretty psyched, and we were definitely like, you know, shouting from time to time at each other, just like how cool the pitch looked and how like rad the position was the next person looked in. But it was this weird sort of just like everybody was all in, and it was kind of almost just like, yeah, kind of like what Jackson said every morning. It was just like we're going up, and every pitch it was just like we're going up. And it was kind of this weird, like almost like lucid dream conveyor belt sort of feeling of just like continuing up the mountain. And it's like, oh, all right, we're doing this again. Okay, we're still going. All right, it's like we've been up here a week, and all right, it's still happening, it's still reasonable, like everything seems like it's okay, like why wouldn't we go up, you know? So
yeah, second that in a big way.
So coming down, did you rappel your route, or did you come down a different way?
We more or less rappelled our route, with the exception of, because our route kind of like traverses up this arcing corner system, but we more or less just kind of went straight down from our high bivvy, because there's so many sheets of ice that we could wrap on mostly threads. Once we hit the ramp, you're kind of on the same route that you climbed up.
Right. Are there sections you can just down climb or walk down on that ramp or the plateau, or is it all rappelling the whole way?
It's all rappelling from pretty much the summit, more or less, to the Bergschrund at the Hanging Glacier, and then you can walk through the ice fall, and then you rappel the rock buttress at the start.
Mm-hmm. And did you do all that in one long day then, from the top of the headwall?
Yes, yeah, just from the top of the headwall, around 24,000 feet back to base camp.
Hmm. Wow. So you're all back home now, and it's been almost a month since you got down from the climb. You feel like you're still on a high from it, or is it already fading kind of into distant memory?
It all kind of feels like a bit of a dream. Even from the time we got back to base camp, it was like, oh my God, did that really just happen?
Alan, you're nodding your head.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I don't know. Our sort of style is always we're just always excited to like keep going and keep doing other things. And it was like, yeah, literally we were like, you know, we're already planning the next thing. The day we got down, we're like coordinating whatever, how we're gonna get out of there and how bad our frostbite is. And we're already like, yeah, all right, so okay, this will be healed by this time, so we can launch again by this time. And like, you know, it's just like, it's kind of like you're like, okay, that's done, like we showed, like all right, like we can do this, so let's do it again. All right, where are we gonna go next?
It's funny you say that. I saw a comment on one of your Instagram posts. I think it was Clint Helander said something, and one of you responded, I can't remember who, that about the proof of concept, that this climb was sort of the proof of concept. And, you know, you've said we've got a few ideas to apply our proof of concept to. And, you know, I wouldn't ask you to name any objectives, but, you know, what, after something this huge, is it, you know, is it like something higher, harder, faster? What then motivates you to sort of take the next step?
That's a good question. I don't know. We're not totally sure. That a big reason that we kind of picked to climb this wall, even though it had been climbed once before, was that we thought it was one of the most intimidating looking walls that we could think of. And so I don't know if we'd quantify it as like harder. We're just still excited about aesthetic lines that we think are going to challenge us and provide us with some more adventure and exploration and kind of continue to do more of the same. And if they happen to be higher, they happen to be harder and cool. If they're not, then that's cool as long as we are all still buds and come back from it.
Are you very much talking about things you could do as a team, the three of you?
Yeah, at this point.
Yeah, I think we've spent the last couple of years working together and it's been just been a blast. You know, we all get along super well and seem to work really well together and excited to see it continue.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to put you on the spot and ask you, do you feel like this climb of Jannu, Alpine style, ascent of the North Face, new route, does it, in your minds, make a statement of any kind about the nature of Himalayan climbing today or what it should be?
I don't think we're trying to make a statement. We're just trying to climb in a way that's fun for us and that we feel like is a ton of adventure and sort of just the most logical way of going to climb a mountain isn't putting 10 miles of rope on it. It's just you start at the bottom and you go climbing and you climb as high as you can. And then you can't, you go down. And I don't know. That's just what makes sense to us. I'm not trying to advocate that everyone needs to climb in that style or anything like that. But I don't know. This is just a feature that we were excited to try and climb in this way. And that's kind of the way that we'll continue to try and climb in the mountains.
What about, and again, if you're not comfortable answering this, don't. But I'm curious if you feel like the Russian route is a line that should have sort of waited for a future generation. And by that, I mean your generation.
We did talk about this a little bit where like it is, you know, I should preface this by saying that I think we all like a lot of respect for the Russians and the fact that they got that done because there was a lot of people trying that line in Alpine style at the time and no one was succeeding and they did. We do find it, you know, somewhat unfortunate with it being such a prominent line up that face that it would be harder to try and like good Alpine style now.
Right. All right. I have a final question for each of you. And before your memories all fade away, your dream state, I want each of you to see if you can describe a moment or something from the climb that really stands out. Something that you think you'll remember forever. Just a highlight. Alan?
Yeah, I think the moment that probably sticks out in my head is we are high bivvy at like whatever 74 or 50 meters somewhere in there. We're like we get in there and we get settled in there and we're sort of like making water and stuff. And I don't know, at that for me, kind of every one of the more exciting things in a climb is sort of when things shift from thinking that it's like you're not quite sure if it's going to happen to being pretty sure it's going to happen. And I remember like sitting in there and I was like, guys, like, I know we still got like a shitload of work to do, but like, I kind of feel like we just did something kind of crazy. And you guys were kind of like, yeah, like, I think you're probably right. And that was sort of like the end of the discussion because I don't think any of us wanted to jinx it because we knew we still had some real things that needed to align for us. But that was kind of the moment where it's like, whoa, like we have like one pitch of ice left to like get to the shoulder and then like we're gonna figure it out after that. And so yeah, I would say that was sort of a time that'll probably stick with me.
Nice. What about you, Matt?
I would kind of going back to the high bivvy and the experience that we had up there. I can't speak for Jackson or Alan, but I feel like when we were in the bivvies, I had this very prevalent feeling of having like a fourth person up there and kind of having like this surreal experience of just feeling that kind of energy. And it I feel like it was at our high bivvy for both nights that I felt that. And it was just like something that I've never felt before and something I couldn't explain. And I couldn't tell you if it was the altitude or anything else, but it was just like a really crazy thing to kind of experience up there.
Wow. That's a phenomenon that's been described before. High altitude climbs did you recognize this person or?
I couldn't tell you who it was, but it was like a really kind of like calming energy. It was positive. Yeah.
Wow. Cool. Jackson?
I would have to say the thing that's been sticking with me and coming back up in my thoughts surrounding the climb the most was when we were going to the top the last day. And I was just feeling like a tremendous amount of love, like finishing it out. and like had a couple specific people like that were coming to mind the whole time. And that was pretty powerful to just like have those people sort of with me and in my thoughts going to the top.
Hmm. Oh, great. Well, listen, I could ask questions all day about this climb, but we've covered a lot of ground. And I just want to say congratulations on a great climb. And thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for your interest.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
The Cutting Edge is not only a podcast, but also the American Alpine Club's top grant for expeditionary climbing. This team was supported by two large Cutting Edge grants in 2022 and 23. In fact, the AAC provides many types of grants for climbers pushing their boundaries in all different ways. Find out more at AmericanAlpineClub.org. Janu, by the way, is the name that Cutting Edge presenting sponsor Hilleberg the Tent Maker gives to one of its flagship models, a very strong two-person tent for all kinds of alpine challenges. Learn about the full line of Hilleberg tents at Hilleberg.com. We get additional support from Bivouac Coffee and Blue Ice. Thanks to Sierra McGivney for her editing help. It should be obvious, but some of the tactics described here, especially the fix and follow technique, are in experts-only terrain. There have been some serious accidents recently involving rope soloing or ascending with micro-tractions and similar devices. If you're keen to experiment with these tools, get proper instruction and always back them up. This is Dougal McDonald, wishing you safe and happy climbs.